sangye chutang soki chunam la jangchu bardu dagni kyab suchi dagi jin sogi pi sonam gi drola penje zongi du parshu. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect, by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Until I am enlightened through the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints, from the virtuous merits that I collect, by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and clean. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by and ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha room, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure lands. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Saparipada Ratna Mandala Buddha Mega Samudra Saparana Samaye. Welcome to the 12th session of Parting from the Four Attachments. So, we had a couple of weeks off, so maybe I'll just review where we've come from and where we're going here. So the first two lines of Parting from the Four Attachments have to do with, basically, with renunciation, developing really strong renunciation that worldly life is not worth clinging to and samsara in general is not worth clinging to. And then we go on to the third line, which is the one we're working on. If you have attachment to your own purpose, you do not have the enlightenment thought. That enters into the discussion of what is the enlightenment thought and how do we develop it. It's a progression that we go through steps in order to get to the enlightenment thought, to really have it solidly and firmly in our being. It needs to be cultivated. You know, like a plant in the spring has to be watered and fertilized and all that good stuff. So the way that we do that is we start with loving kindness, which is the wish that beings be happy or have happiness and the causes of happiness. And there's a progressive meditation that we go through when we do that and the subsequent meditations, where we start with our mother and we think of her kindness and we really remember all the many, 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 many things that our mother, or the person who's the equivalent of our mother if we didn't have a mother, but somebody raised us to the point where we're adults, and we really appreciate it. It's about appreciation, really, is what it's about. And we acknowledge it and we appreciate it. And then we go to the next step. Oh, sorry. Before that, we do that meditation short. And then we do it again with our father. And then we do it again with our relatives. And then we do it again with our neighbors and our co-workers and the people that we know and associate with. And then we do it to the people we're indifferent to, which is most the biggest group. And then we do it to our enemies or the people who are creating obstacles for us. So even if you don't have enemies, there's probably somebody in your life that's creating obstacles at one time or another. And then eventually we expand it to all sentient beings. You can also go through, if you want, you can go through the six realms and focus on each realm, starting from the lowest realms, the hell realm, hungry ghosts, animals, and so on. And you can apply that meditation all the way through the realms. Meditation doesn't have to be really, really long. In fact, it shouldn't be really, really long. But it should be focused and frequent. And that process needs to be cultivated over time. It doesn't happen just instantly. Once we've cultivated loving kindness, then we move on to compassion, which is wanting to take away suffering. So loving kindness is wanting to give happiness. Compassion is wanting to take away suffering and the causes of suffering. So if we look at all of those beings in the meditation that we did on loving kindness, we'll see very quickly that they are suffering. They're in samsara, they're suffering by definition. So then we go through the same meditation again with those same groups, only this time with compassion, wanting to take away their suffering. My mother is suffering, I really would like to take away her suffering. Wouldn't it be great if I could take away my mother's suffering? And then my father, and then my family, and so on through the list. We went through this before. And you do the same sequence, only with compassion. You can't skip loving kindness and compassion, because if you do, when we get to the next step of enlightenment thought, it'll be weak. You won't have much oomph in your meditation. You won't really be motivated to develop and accomplish the enlightenment thought, because that's a big undertaking. And so in order to have that motivation strong enough, you need to do these previous steps. There's a reason that these are in order this way. Loving kindness is easy to develop. You know, love is pretty natural. And then compassion. And then when we get up to enlightenment thought, we have the thought, well, I'd really like to take away the suffering and give happiness to all sentient beings, but how can I? I'm not capable, I'm not able, I don't have the power. Who does? Well, a fully enlightened Buddha does. Basically, by teaching these steps. By teaching. Can't do it for us, but can show us the way. So, enlightenment thought is broken down into two kinds. Aspiration, or what's commonly called wishing. Mm-hmm. I really wish I could do this. I really wish I could take away suffering and give happiness. And that's an important step, because everything sort of starts with a dream first before it's actualized. You know, all the buildings you see and all the great art and whatever, you know, it's all an aspiration at one point first, or a wish or a desire. And then it's actualized. And that's the second step in the enlightenment thought, is what's called entering or doing or actualizing. There's different translations, but that's when you actually do it. You do the work, you do the steps that it takes, the practices and so on. And later on we'll get into more specifically, well, what are the practices, but that's coming. But we decide to enter, to do it, to really start this incredible journey towards enlightenment. So the example that's classically given in this case is, if I want to make a trip, I'll have the idea, oh, I'd really like to go to wherever. And you think about it and you go, oh, yeah, I really want to do that. Then, if you really want to do it, you have to do it. You have to get the plane ticket or whatever, the visa or the passport or whatever you need for the actual trip, buy the ticket, get the funds, buy the ticket. And that's basically what we're doing. We're on a journey. We aspire to make this journey, and then we decide we're gonna do it. We're gonna enter, do the practices. Enlightenment thought also has, I sort of skipped a step here, I'll go back. Enlightenment thought has two kinds, relative and absolute. We're going to talk about absolute later on the fourth attachment. So that'll be covered later. The relative is what I just said, aspiration and entering. Which we see over here. I've rewritten this side of the chart for those of you that are following or kept copying. So we've done the aspiration enlightenment thought, and we've decided to enter into the path. That has steps too. It's all broken down in steps, so we know, you know, how to do it basically and how to do it correctly. So that's kind of where we've arrived, is at entering. And there are two meditations under entering: equalizing self and others, and exchanging self and others. And so we're going to start talking about those topics. But before I actually start on the new material, I just wanted to wrap up something that came up last class. I mentioned this idea of skillful means, where we really only have a very short amount of time here in our precious human rebirth. We've talked about that extensively down here with the first two lines. And so part of skillful means is to take advantage of the time that we have and not waste it. Because actually, in terms of spiritual practice, we waste a lot of time. We have virtuous and non-virtuous activities, but also neutral activities. And most of our activities during the day are neutral, I would say. Walking, eating, washing your hands, you know, all these daily life activities that we do, they're basically neutral. They don't have a particular virtuous or non-virtuous quality to them, other than what we make. And so skillful means refers to making neutral activities virtuous. And that's what really skillful bodhisattva practitioners do. They don't waste any of their time. They take their neutral activities and turn them into virtuous activities. And I gave a few brief examples last time. And I mentioned in Clarifying the Sage's Intent by Sakyapandita that there were lots and lots of examples. And Finley said, "Oh, what page what page are they on?" I didn't have the page number memorized, but I looked it up. There are actually different books that cover this text of Clarifying the Sage's Intent. This is the actual text by Sakyapandita, who is in that tanka there. This is a modern commentary by a very famous lama named Khenchen Abhi Rinpoche, who wrote an interesting commentary on Sakyapandita's book, or text, because Sakyapandita's text is actually sort of like a teacher's manual. And so there'll be teachings and commentary, and then Sakyapandita will say, "And at this point, the teacher should tell the story about the seven sisters who were reborn." But he doesn't tell the story in there. You're supposed to know that. Ape Rinpoche's book is very helpful because a lot of the stories are in here. So these two books kind of complement each other. And there are also examples in here about how to do skillful means. Since I looked up the pages, I thought it might be interesting to just read a couple of these examples. And if anybody wants to write it down, it's page 450 in the Sakyapandita book and page 72 in the Ape Rinpoche book. And there are literally pages of examples in here. And it's pretty small print, too. But really, the idea is to just stimulate our own creativity, to make up our own aspirations, to convert neutral activity into virtuous activity. I'll just read a few examples just to kind of stimulate your imagination and your creativity. So this is directly from Sakyapandita himself, just a few examples. So for example, when closing a door, you can think, "May the door to the three lower realms be closed for all sentient beings." Mm-hmm. And just by having that, when we say "may I," that's what? That's an aspiration, right? So we're making aspirations, we're feeding our aspiration garden. When going uphill, "May I and sentient beings be established in the pleasures of the higher realms of rebirth." When lifting your foot, "May all sentient beings be brought forth from cyclic existence." How many times in a day do you lift your foot? When you see somebody wearing jewelry, may I gain the marks and auspicious characteristics of a Buddha. When a person becomes enlightened, they attain various bodies, and one of them is a Buddha body that has certain marks on it, specific physical characteristics, like the tongue is really long, the fingers are webbed. There's many, many, many of these characteristics, dozens of them. You can see on that statue, there's Sakyapandita statue. He has a thing on his head. That's one of the marks. The Ushnisha, that's where the Buddha's consciousness is, the super consciousness. So that's what this refers to, the marks of a Buddha. When you see somebody who's suffering or an animal who's suffering, may the suffering of all beings be pacified. So just very simple statements that are aspirational. You can convert your neutral activities into virtuous activities. Then, afterwards, of course, you dedicate the merit and you consolidate that spiritual energy. Okay. So those are some from Sakyapandita. Apa Rinpoche has several pages, too. When opening a door, may the gate to the city of liberation be opened. So enlightenment sometimes is referred to as the city of liberation. That's just a way of referring to it. When you see somebody who's not wearing jewelry, we'll cover everybody, jewelry or without jewelry. May I come to possess the excellent qualities of a purified person. Those are just a few ideas to give you some stimulation for making up your own as you go through your day, if you want. Okay, so we're going to go now to talk about equalizing self and others. I'll give you sort of the description of the meditation first. And hopefully you're doing these at home. The 42nd Sakyatrizin said, engaging bodhicitta, which is another way of saying entering enlightenment thought. Those are synonyms, okay? Engaging bodhicitta means engaging in Dharma practice in order to attain Buddhahood. No one can reach Buddhahood without the proper causes and conditions for attaining it. It's just like wanting to become a scholar. No one can become a scholar without studying and training. There are many kinds of scholars in the world in different fields. All of them studied hard and completed the educational requirements that were needed to become experts. Similarly, without practicing the Dharma, no one can attain Buddhahood. So Buddha can't do it for us, we have to do it. He showed us the way, but we have to do it ourselves. So in terms of equalizing self and others, His Eminence Chogyi Trichin Rinpoche said, we must first learn to regard other beings as more important than ourselves. But how does this come about? Once we have established a heartfelt altruistic motivation as a basis, we will be able to properly meditate on the equality of self and others. In addition to developing love and compassion, we also need to give rise to the immeasurable quality of the equality of self and others. In this regard, it's important to understand that every sentient being wishes to be happy, just as we do. They do not want suffering, just as we do not. Reflecting on this will enable us to empathize, to put ourselves in the other person's place, to meditate on the commonality and equality of ourselves and all other beings. This is the practice of equalizing self and others. So in a way, it's simple. It's just simply recognizing, okay, I want to be happy. So does everybody else. all sentient beings, not just human beings, all sentient beings. I don't want to suffer. Neither does anybody else. No sentient beings. Even if you just take a single cell organism and you poke it, it'll move away. These are just basic principles of life. To want happiness and to not want suffering. But what's the real situation? The real situation is we do suffer and we don't have permanent happiness. That's why we're involved in this. The first step in this two-step process is the equalizing. Recognizing the equality of all of us. Just like I don't want to suffer, nobody else wants to suffer. Now, you can just think the thought in the meditation. This is analytical meditation. It's okay to think in analytical meditation. And if you want to do that, that's fine. There is another way of doing it, which is to actually visualize. And again, we start with our mother, and then we go to our father, and then we do our family, and then we do our neighbors, and then we do neutral people, and then we do our enemies, and then we do all sentient beings. So that stays the same all the way through. We're going to use that format here, too. Another way of doing the meditation is to actually visualize it. What do you visualize? Like a teeter-totter, sort of, or a scale with balances, you know, a balance scale. So you put yourself on one side, and you visualize yourself on one side if you're good at visualizing, and then you put your mother on the other side. And you say, well, yeah, okay, those are equal. The teeter-totter is equal. And then you, next meditation, you put your father there. Then when you put your family there, you've got a few more people on this side. But the teeter-totter doesn't tilt either way. It still stays the same. I want to be happy. They want to be happy. I don't want to suffer. They don't want to suffer. Okay. And then your neighbors. The crowd gets bigger. Then you put your neighbors on there, but nothing changes. It still stays the same. It's equal. I want to be happy. They want to be happy. And you keep adding on the neutral beings. And then you add on your enemies and your obstructors. And then you add on all sentient beings, which are infinite. We've already talked about that in the past. And still, it's the same. There is no difference. So if you're a visual person and you like to visualize and that works for you, you can do that kind of visualization in this meditation. But the point is that the teeter-totter never wavers one way or another. It's equal. It stays the same. Remember, we're trying to develop loving kindness and compassion where we give happiness and we take away suffering. So we haven't forgotten that part of it. We've built on that foundation. Okay? So that's kind of a description of the meditation when you do it. There was a very brilliant practitioner, philosopher called Garampa Sonam Senge, who wrote a commentary on Parting from the Four Attachments. And in his commentary about this topic, he wrote, when you're doing the meditation, you should think, just as I want happiness, so do all sentient beings also want happiness. Therefore, just as I would accomplish my own happiness, so I must also accomplish the happiness of all sentient beings. Just as I do not want suffering, so do all sentient beings also not want suffering. Therefore, just as I would remove my own suffering, so I must also remove the suffering of all sentient beings. So those were his descriptive words about how to think the meditation if you want to do it analytically. Now, these two topics of equalizing and exchanging are really important. They're critical. We're at a critical junction here. I mean, all the topics are important, but this is where we kind of up our game, so to speak. in terms of a spiritual practitioner, we're not just worried about getting some bliss for ourselves, but we're actually getting into this bodhisattva practice of actually attaining enlightenment for the sake of others. I wanted to be really, really clear before teaching this topic tonight, so I had extensive discussions with Lama Jampa about this week. And he had some interesting comments to make about it. And I'll share a couple of them with you. Because I've heard this teaching before, and you probably have too, or you may have too, but he had some interesting nuances that I hadn't heard before. One of the things that he said was, when you go through the progression here of your mother, your father, your family, and so on and so on and so on, one of the crucial points, or maybe even the crucial point, is when you get to your enemies. And as I said, I like to think I don't have any enemies, but I certainly have people that obstruct me from time to time. So if you say, well, I don't have any enemies, you can think of your obstructors. But that meditation is, according to Lama, is really critical. Because it's easy to love your mother, you know, your father. But if you've got somebody that's really making trouble for you in your life, that's where the rubber hits the road, you know, that's the test, that's the challenge, right? So he gave great emphasis to that aspect of this progressive meditation, that you really want to work on that one, and that's where you can really make an important change in your spiritual development. You know, love thine enemies as thyself. It's easy to say. What he said is, well, he said a few things, but he said what we've said before, which is because sentient beings are infinite and rebirth is beginningless, that means that all sentient beings have been our mother. So all these warm feelings and love and compassion that we have for our mother, our enemy has been our mother, but it's our fault that we don't see that because we have delusions. And those delusions blind us to our past lives and seeing the person who's making trouble for us as our mother and remembering all the kindness that they did for us and how they gave us life and they taught us how to speak and socialized us and fed us and cleaned us and raised us. We don't see that now because we're deluded, and that's our fault. That's our lack, so to speak. And so Lama said we need to really bring mindfulness to this situation. We need to go through that process and remember that they have in fact been kind to us in the past. Now, if they're mistreating us now, whose fault is that? It's my fault. Because they wouldn't be mistreating me if I hadn't mistreated them. The law of karma says that. That's a karmic debt that I incurred in the past, and they're just paying it back, paying me back. And so it really isn't their fault. It's I caused it. So I'm having all this grief from this person, but actually I caused it in the first place. So we need to remember that aspect of it, too. Okay? And not only that, but they're actually being kind by hassling me. Because by doing that, they're extinguishing that karma. It's done. It's free, it's clean, it's gone. Once the karma is activated, so to speak, or actualized, that's it, it's over. So if I don't react to that hassle, it's it. There's no more karma there. So they're actually extinguishing my debt to them, which is good. If they didn't, then it would always be there waiting to be actualized because karma doesn't disappear. It's waiting for the right conditions to actualize it. Causes and conditions, right? You have the seed, the karmic seed, and then you have the conditions, the fertilizer, the water, the sunshine, and all that. Well, they are providing the conditions by showing up and hassling you. Now, this is a stretch for some people, and that's why I think Lama emphasized this, is this is the one that we really need to not, you know, skip over, but really actually purify. And if you do it right, you're purifying your own karma, in effect. If, on the other hand, you react back to them, well, you've just started the whole circle again. You've created the karma of wounding them, and that's going to come back and bite you in the future. So that's why patience is emphasized in the six perfections, you know. It's one of the main, in fact, some teachers say it's there's no practice like patience. You know. So we really have to work on our patience so that when that situation arises that we don't react back and don't create more karma and don't start the wheel turning again. Lama said that when you're doing this particular section to go slow. I think what he was saying was you can't cheat, you can't skip over it. If you're really going to make a change in your spiritual side and your spiritual development, you have to be honest with yourself and actually change your attitude. All of this is a mind practice, all of it. Even the actual physical activities, like generosity, it's a mind practice. So I think what he was getting at is you really want to make sure that you're making this change in your mind, and the enemy is giving you that opportunity. Otherwise, you'd still have that karma just hanging in your karmic bag, in your karmic bank account. And he said that if you do this fully and correctly, you do actually do this meditation with your so-called enemies, eventually you will come to see them the same as you see your parents. That there is an actual transformation that can happen within you and your vision. And as I've said before, Geshe Thachi Namgyo used to say that really, really good practitioners, when they find somebody that's really a hassle, or really giving them a lot of grief, that they will actually give gifts to that person so that that person will continue to hang around them and hassle them. Because it gives them a chance to practice patience. There's a very famous Indian lama named Atisha, who was one of the people who was responsible for bringing Buddhism to Tibet. And when he went to Tibet, he had an entourage or a group of attendants and so forth. And apparently one of his attendants was just a real pain and was just the grumpiest, sourest, most unpleasant person you could ever want to be around. And everybody was like, Lama, teacher, why do you, this guy is, can't we get rid of him, you know? And he's like, no, it's because he's a hassle, that's why I'm keeping him deliberately. Of course, he was a great lama, but still, we can get the idea and aspire to develop our patience and to do this part of the meditation with great vigor. And then Lama said, when you've done that, well, you should think, I did a really good practice today thanks to my enemy. That's what you should tell yourself at the end, just to remind yourself what this is about here. And you should think, my enemy helps me. Or in my case, my landlady that won't fix my leaky roof. I'm sure you'll find somebody in your life to do this meditation. Somebody in traffic driving in from Langford, right?
There's a few of those.
Yeah, there's a few of them, right? So the idea is this idea of equalizing, of just putting everybody on the same balance scale, you know, as I am. I want to be happy, I don't want to suffer. Yeah, everybody else. So that's the first step in this two-step process. These meditations don't have to be very long, but they should be frequent. They should be repeated. Because like any habit that you're trying to change, you know, repetition is often a key tool in doing that. So that's the advice. Yeah, so that's Lama Jampa's insight about this section. And he had some other comments. As we go further, I'll say what else he said. Equalizing self and others. Are there any questions about that?
A question about the line itself, not having attachment to one's own purpose. Well, it must be very different sort of specific instructions for lay people and monastics, because we have very different sort of purposes that we cling to. In the text that you read, is there any difference that's made between the purposes of a householder and the purposes of a monastic, and how different they are, or is it?
In a word, no. As always, everything comes from motivation. So it isn't so much what you do as why you do it. Because, as we've seen in past teachings, sometimes circumstances require you to break the rules, so to speak, to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If your motivation is pure, sometimes you actually should break the rules. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't be, you know, narrow-minded, oh, I have to follow the rule.
Right.
And
right.
You know, there's a famous story that there were two monks walking on the road, and you know, normally monks are not supposed to have contact with women, and nuns are not supposed to have contact with men. That's one of the rules. They have lots and lots of rules, vows. And then the story goes that the two monks were walking along, they came to a stream, and there was a woman there, and she was trying to get across the stream, and she couldn't get across, and she said, "Would you please carry me across?" And one of the monks said, "Yeah." And she got on his back, and he carried her across the stream and put her down, and she said, "Thank you." And they said, "You're welcome." And they went on their way. And the two monks continued to walk. And then at a certain point, the monk who didn't carry the woman, you could tell his mind was going, you know, and he was saying to himself, you know, "Not supposed to do that. You broke the rules." And then finally he couldn't take it anymore, and he finally said to the other monk, "You broke the rules when you gave that woman a lift." And the other monk said, "Well, I put her down on the other side of the river, but you're still carrying her." In other words, yeah, he broke the rules, but he was helping somebody, so that takes precedence. So to answer you, no, I haven't seen anything in any of these texts about that particularly, but there's lots of talk about motivation.
Great.
You know, bodhisattva motivation in this case. It's true, though, that the lifestyle is quite different, generally. Any other questions about this? Okay, so I've described the meditation. Let's sample it here together. So find yourself a posture that's comfortable for you to sit upright, preferably with your spine elongated. And just take a moment to transition from all these words. And just take a moment to think about yourself on the one hand and your mother on the other hand in some way. See yourself and see your mother. And think about, what is the situation? Well, the situation is, I want to be happy. And of course, so does my mother. And I don't want to suffer. And of course, likewise, neither does my mother. And that's the situation, that we are equal in that. And now next to your mother, you can imagine your father. And what is your father's situation? Well, it's the same as mine. I want to be happy. My father wants to be happy. I don't want to suffer, and neither does he. And now you can put your whole family there as a group. The situation is the same. I want to be happy. And so does everyone in my family. I don't want to suffer, and neither do they. We're all equal. And all of my friends and my co-workers and my neighbors join the crowd. And their situation and my situation is the same. We want to be happy. We don't want to suffer. And all the people that I'm indifferent to, many, many people, situation is the same. We all want to be happy, and none of us want to suffer. And now arrives my enemy, or the person who is obstructing me. They want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. Remembering that they aren't really my enemy, I just see them as that way. They're actually one of my previous mothers. Our father, our family, and there's really no difference. They want to be happy, they don't want to suffer. And all the beings in the realm of samsara, all sentient beings, are the same. Wanting happiness, not wanting suffering. And I can remember this after the meditative session is over. I can remember this, that every being is the same as me. So according to Lama, we can now think, I did a good practice today thanks to my enemy. And we'll do the dedication prayer now. So nam de tam cha zi pa mi to na nye pe da nam pam je te ye na ga chi ta lung fu pe yi si pe tso le do wa dru ar shu jang chu sem cho grim po che ma ke pa nam ke gur chi ke ma nam par me par yang gong ne gong tu pel par shu jam pao pao o ji tar ken pa dong kun tu sang po de yang de shin de de da kung gi je su da lo chi ge wa di da tam che ra tu mo tu sung che pi gya wa tam che ki no wa gang la chung du nga pa gi dang shen ge we tsa wa di kun kyang sang po cho chi ra tu ngo chak sa wa dang cho ching sha pa dang je su yi rong ku shing so wa yi ge wa chuk ze da gi chi sak pa dang je zog pe jang chu chi. By this merit, may all attain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious, may it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen. May it never decline where it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way valiant Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues that I may train to be like them. Through this dedication, praised as supreme by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever little virtue I may have gained from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment. So next week we will continue with the second part of this entering, which is the exchanging part, and that's the really main part of it, the major part of it, the most important part. So that'll be a follow-up to what we did tonight. That'll be like part 2.